And all of a sudden I saw the door wiggling, you know, and I'm like, is he going to run? You know, remember, I thought he's a local guy to go down this railroad avenue already, you know, and they always run, you know, opens the door. And all I saw was, and I saw the ground bouncing. And I was like, oh, you know, and now I'm firing. I think they found one of my first rounds, which is nothing but suppression. I think I hit the house behind the car. There was nothing like, eh, let me line this up. You know, it was bam. Oh, you know, I'm being shot at. I may have been gangster style with it sideways. I don't even remember. And there was a telephone pole to my left. And I ran to the pole. And the way he was doing it, he couldn't get his door open. So he reaches out and he knows there's a cop here and there's a cop back here. And he just starts bam, 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 just shooting.
So, like, and the folks can't see you. So what you're saying is he's reaching out with his right hand. So if he's facing forward like it's 12 o'clock, he's like trying to shoot at his 4 o'clock and his 7 o'clock or something like that. Right.
And he's shooting between the door because the door can't get open because of the impact. It can get open a little bit. So he can't, and he doesn't know shoot through the window. So he's trying to shoot me around the door. It was not the best position for him at that point. So I get to the pole. Now I'm able to just start laying down. I'm just shooting at that box area where I had seen the threat before, you know, pretty much his car window. Monroe comes over with me. He's laying shots down and we end up getting together. And now we just start like in tandem, bah, bah, giving verbal commands. You know, the shooting is about 2 minutes long if you listen to the whole thing. And there was a point where he's still moving and we approach the car and he's still messing with the gun. And then I remember, I don't know if Monroe shot at that point, but I remember putting 4 rounds through the window into his body. Like I can remember, like I can taste it. And I remember, hold on. Sometimes I...
That's all right, bro. It's all right.
So I try to tell people it's a very primal place to be. You know, at that moment, you could almost imagine those guys that beheaded a guy in battle. You know, because you were so angry and I felt this power, you know, we back up. I remember a SWAT guy tapping me on the shoulder. He's like, he's got the long gun. He's like, Eric, we got this. We got this. You know, and I back up and I'm still like jacked up. You know, then I hear the sirens, you know, all the sirens are still going on, the verbal commands. But, you know, for that 2 minute period, I was just in the zone, you know, and damn, I haven't locked up about it in a while. Sorry.
Not a problem.
So,
well, the other thing, he did tap you on the shoulder. I watched the video. He grabbed your ass and he started pulling you back. I mean,
that's one of the misconceptions. That's not even me. That's the third officer that showed up. I had a ride along from the local university. So she's sitting in the passenger seat.
Were you then to the left of that officer or to the right?
I'm to the left. When that officer gets grabbed, you'll see a guy approach the window in shorts. That's how you know it's me. And fires the rounds in. So he was going to go, you know, he's going to get in freaking crossfire. That's why Matt pulled him back to get him out of the way. Right at that point is when I'm shooting in the car window. So that's where people get distracted. They think it's me getting pulled back. Now, I'm already shot at this point. I don't even know it. So when the SWAT guy taps me on the shoulder, which is off camera, you know, I back up and I remember backing up and it's like, holy cow, you know, and I looked down because I felt pain in my foot and I saw the 3 holes through my shoe.
Three?
And then I looked at my... Yeah, well, it went long way. So it went in through the big toe area, out the side, and back in through the back part of my heel. So it just did a straight line like a laser. And it just ripped the line like it burnt, like a drill. If you took a drill and went like, that's what it did to my foot. But it missed the big toe. It just went on the side of the big toe through the, you know, the meaty part of the left part of my foot. A lot of nerve damage, but luckily there's no structural damage. You know, I can walk and run. I can still do stuff. And then the right leg, there's another shot off my right leg that grazed me, but enough to make the bullet blind and the blood dripping down. So I remember looking down going, holy shit, was that from the rocks in the ground? And Monroe yells, Eric, you all right or something? I remember, and I'm like, I got shot. He's like, you got shot. What the heck? You know, and then, you know, all the cavalry shows up and they, one of the cool things about the shooting, which is goes back to your training. I was never a gun guy. I didn't carry a gun off duty before a lot because I was, you know, I didn't want to be out drinking when my buddies have a gun and get into some stuff. You know, if I went somewhere, I would bring it. But I don't count rounds. So here I am shooting at this target, this guy, this ghost. And I remember something saying, dude, you're about to run out of bullets. And sure enough, I looked at my slide came back. Best transition.
Yep.
best transition I ever had. It was smooth. It was quick, right back in the fight. And I always remember telling people, I go, man, I don't even know why I knew I was going to. It's just something, you know, you shoot enough times, you kind of know, oh, I'm about to run out. And it was right on cue, man. It was really great that that was in my subconscious. Not that it would have changed the outcome, but it would have stopped me from fumbling around.
Well, you're amazed at what you remember, even during stressful or, you know, tactical situations. What kind of sidearm were you guys equipped with?
At that point, I had a Glock. It was a 21, a 45 caliber.
Oh, okay.
Monroe was shooting a 40. So we ended up, I remember being in the ambulance going to the hospital. And it didn't have, the AC wasn't working because it was condensation was spitting like water out. And the guy was like, I'm sorry, bro. This rig is just dying. I'm like, man, I get shot and I get it right in a hot ambulance all the way to the hospital. And I'm asking for water because I'm really dehydrated from all the excitement. And they're like, yeah, you don't want to drink the water on here. I'm like, what the heck? You know, I want to drink some water. I mean, wow. I thought I'd get a helicopter, like, you know, but police cars leading me away, like on the movies. Nah, it wasn't any of that. So I remember asking him, though, and this is where it was pretty crazy. It was, hey, what happened to the bad guy? Because I never knew 100% that he was dead. You know, I thought he might be, but I didn't know, you know, and I asked him. He's like, nah, he's dead. And then it was like, oh, shit, we just killed somebody. And then it starts that whole other, man, did we shoot too much? Was it the bank robber? I still don't even know it's the bank robber. I thought it was, but I really didn't know. You know, and then the, you know, am I going to be judged? Am I going to be held accountable? And then you start going down that road, you know.
Go back to the initial thing. Did you see the weapon at all? Or is your first recognition something's going on is just hearing the shots? Was it so dark you couldn't see the weapon and it was just the shots?
It was the flash and I never saw the gun. I mean, he was shooting an HK at us, a 40 caliber. And he actually had a stovepipe. It actually doubled up because he was using different, you know, different types of rounds in there and stuff. Oh, yeah. I mean, they were all 40, but they were different shell casing, you know, types. And, you know, he was limperousing it. So, you know, that's just going to happen. It's going to get, you know, so he's trying to clear out a stovepipe. And that's when we were lights out.
Can you explain to our listeners what a stovepipe is?
Oh, it's when the shell case, as it's firing, it can't eject properly. And the next round will kind of get wedged in with it, but it will make it stick up like a chimney pipe. You know, it's... I've had it happen to me a couple times shooting on the range, you know, messing around. But that, you know, that was one of the things they said he was trying to do, and it made sense.
It's where you learn tap, rack, and bang.
Yeah, he didn't know that, luckily. You know,
but, thank goodness.
I know, but yeah. So you know, you get to the hospital, and you know, I remember two things on the way to the hospital. I called my buddy about basketball because I was one of 10 guys, and I knew he had to fill that 10th spot, and I didn't want to be that guy. So I call him. And I'm like, Mike, I can't make it, dude. He's like, dude, you're number 10. We got to run half. I go, I got shot, dude. I'm on my way to the hospital. He's like, you called me? I go, well, I want you to fill that spot in. He's like, dude, freaking get out of here. So he hangs up the phone and I call my wife, and or I may have called her first. I don't remember the order. And she picks up and she's got my son who's 3 months old, my oldest, and he's crying, you know, and she's like, hey, I go, hey, honey, I'm on my way to the hospital. There was an incident. I'm going to get some stitches in my foot. And she goes, okay, everything good? I go, yeah. She's like, okay. She hangs up. And I was like,
there was an incident. Oh, there was an incident. Yeah.
Well, you know, you're protecting, you know, and she's with the kid. The last thing I want to do is have a police car roll up in front of the house and scare the hell out of her.
Weren't you? But did you get to a point where you were concerned, though, that she was going to hear the information, though, about what really happened? When did she actually find out what happened?
Well, they sent a police car to the house, picked her up. Brought her and my kid to the hospital, okay. Which probably should have left her at home because the kid was now he's in this environment of the hospital and it's his bedtime and he's crying and now she's stressed out. And now she's like, hey, by the way, your husband got shot. She's like, what? You know, should just left her at home. But, it, you know, everyone's there and, you know, doctor's pulling out pieces of bullet fragment out of my foot. And I remember her being a female and she pulled out a piece that hurt. I was like, oh, bitch. And she's like, oh, yeah. And she poked me again to fuck with me. And I was like, ah, I wasn't calling you a bitch. I was calling the pain, you know? And anyways, you know, she was a good looking doctor. So all the guys were coming, all the bosses, they weren't coming to see me. They wanted to see this foot doctor and it was doing her residency or whatever. So anyways, you know, that night I remember I was a big basketball guy then before I figured out it was all fixed and everything, but I was big in the Miami Heat at that point. You know, they had LeBron and Dwayne Wade. Well, they were playing the Oklahoma Thunder in the NBA championship that night. Game one, I remember I took a Percocet and I made me a stiff vodka, you know, don't do that, kids. And I'm sitting there watching the Heat lose game one.
But you don't care. You don't care because you got vodka and a Percocet. You're like, whatever.
Yeah, do as I say, not as I do, right? And I remember the Heat lost. And I'm like, man, they lost on the day I got shot. Dang, you know? And they just lost the year before. So I'm really involved in this series. And then the news comes on. And it goes, dun, 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 tonight at 11, another officer shot in the line of duty. Story next. And I was like, oh, wow. I'm like, holy cow, that's me. Like, it didn't connect because it was like a regular news story. And they're like, tonight, da-da-da. And then all the news stories were covering it. And it was just like, wow, I go to this channel. And then the next morning, you know, dun, dun, dun. It was the headline news in Palm Beach County everywhere. Officer's name is going to be released tomorrow. And I was like, ooh, how's that going to work out, right? Now they're going to know who I am, my family.
After that vodka, I can just sit, you sitting there thinking, hey, who is this guy? What happened?
I slept like a baby, but I had my foot up in a boot. You know, I had to change bandage. I mean, it wasn't like it was that comfortable, but I definitely, you know, numb myself for it. But yeah, and then, you know, a couple of days later, you got to do a workers' comp thing. You got to go to those doctors and, you know, your, you know, handshakes in the department. You know, you're feeling pretty good that you went. Like, I scored the winning touchdown, we won the game kind of thing, you know? You're like, oh, wow, we did it, you know? Luckily, got out of it and went to one psychologist. They sent Chris and I to the same guy at the same time. And then that was it. I never went back because they didn't push it. I didn't push it. Just kind of let it go. And that's part of the other journey I ended up going through with all this because of stuff like that, you know? And
well, let's talk real quick, just procedurally, about the officer-involved shooting. So what was your department's process for that? In other words, were you interviewed right away? Did they let you go? Does your homicide people handle it? Does the state come in? How does that work when you've got a department, when your department's involved in a shooting?
Well, at that point, it would the state attorney's office would come and kind of take over the investigation. And I guess our department would mirror the investigation at that point. But they never interviewed me. I'm at the hospital, and they did a walkthrough with Monroe because he was there, and they did that whole thing with the camera talking to him. I didn't get talked to, I think, for 2 days, and then they finally brought me in and got my official statement. And it wasn't like the movies, how they interview, right? It was kind of like, I'm like, do I got to do any paperwork on this? Because I'm thinking, there's a crash report. I hit three cars. I'm like, that's three crash reports, you know? Where's my car? Where's my stuff? You know, like, I'm still trying to figure out that end of things, you know, what's my next shift? And, you know, it turns out it was 3 months later before I came back. I had to go to physical therapy and all this stuff. But yeah, it was just kind of.
So was there only two moment. Of you involved in the actual shooting, or were more officers involved?
It was only Monroe and I. Other cops obviously had their guns out, didn't shoot. We fired, I think it was around 38 rounds. I fired 18. And Monroe fired his 14 or whatever. I know that because when I got my police car, I'm driving down freaking Congress. I hit my windshield wipers to do the squeegee thing or to clean my windows. And one of the shell casings goes flying out on fucking the highway. And I was like, you guys missed one. That's one of my shell casings because I have them. I ended up doing a tour in evidence for a while. And all that case got disposed of, you know. And I was like, I'm not throwing out these shell casings. Heck, this is, you know, my 17 rounds I got, not 18, because one's floating around the road somewhere. But it was 38 rounds. We hit him 14 times. I was able to see the autopsy and the medical report. You know, he had 4 kill shots, according to the ME, 2 from a 40 caliber, 2 from a 45. So me and Monroe's little joke is always, hey, man, my shot killed him first, and he just kind of peppered a dead guy, you know, and we got to go to Panthers games together. We got to go to Florida Marlins games. So him and I on this journey, we're always kind of, even though we weren't close friends beforehand, this is one of those things that kind of makes you connected for life. And you always pick the phone up and be able to just talk, you know, we're always there for each other. But yeah, only two of us. And, you know, the investigation happens afterward, you know, obviously crime scene, all this stuff. I got an early copy of the video, you know, somebody gets a copy of it and I saw it and they're like, you're good. Don't worry about it. I was like, oh yeah, I'm good. You know, and I hadn't seen the video yet, so finally watched the video, and that's a whole nother thing to look at it all over again from another perspective. And I saw Monroe's car camera too, because he captured more of the chase than mine did. So that's pretty crazy.
When you and we've talked to some other folks about this too, where stuff's been caught on body cam, you know, or an in-car camera. What you thought you saw versus what the camera captured. how close, it's kind of like a Netflix series, right? How much of it is how you remember it? How much of it is like, I didn't realize I did that? You know, when you looked at it, were you pretty close, or did you learn a lot of stuff from watching the video?
I thought I drove pretty well looking back. I was like, wow, you know, I was, because driving that Crown Vic, you know, I mean, that thing hugged some corners. It was beautiful, man. I remember a turn I made to follow him on the railroad. I almost lost it and hit that car that was waiting because I could feel the torque on the car. You could just kind of feel it. And, you know, that's training stuff too. I mean, going out there on the skid pads and stuff like that. So that's not, everything else. It was getting out of the car and unbuckling my seatbelt at the same time and grabbing my handgun. There's all those kind of things I remember very distinctly, you know, never hearing the sirens, you know, and then, you know, the shots that were fired, we fired a lot, man. And not to really even hear those is crazy until the drama stopped. And then it's just like the movies, wah, everything comes back, you know.
At any point, did you feel like, you know, you talk to some people that have been involved in shootings, and it's never happened to me, but some people say things really slow down into slow motion. I have experienced the tunnel vision and the auditory exclusions and things like that. But did you have any of the tunnel vision or the slow down of the process?
Yeah, like exchanging, you know, doing the magazine switch was one, getting out of the car and then moving to my left. All that was very like slow, you know, and I think a lot of playing sports too, you know, you learn to do stuff quick, you know, if you're jumping and you gotta, you know, like we used to do monkey rolls all the time, trying to jump before the next guy took your legs out. And I think the quick thinking stuff is what happens in those situations too, to help you, you know, you got to do something and you're just like on fire. And that's also exhausting. You know, it does take its toll on you, but yeah, that, everything else is just surreal at that point. And then, you know, obviously, making sure I got cleared through the state attorney's office was my next kind of, I was scared that they were going to say I shot too much because he had stopped shooting because of the stovepipe. But we continued to shoot because he wasn't listening to what we were saying. He's still trying to clear the gun out, but the public doesn't see that on the video, you know? And that's what I was worried about, that am I going to get judged now? And then, let's face it, even though I'm a Cuban guy that looks like a white guy, it's a white guy killing a black guy and it's a cop killing a black guy. So that's been, it got bigger over the years, but at the point it was still a very hot topic and it was on my subconscious. It weighed on me, you know?
Yeah, but you know, still got the weapon in his hand, still actively trying to, you know, work the jam out. He's still trying to engage. I mean, the thing you look at too is that does he pose a continuing threat? If he had dropped the weapon out the window and stuck his both hands out and you continued to shoot, yeah, different story. That's not the case. This guy here is attempting to clear, which kind of leads me to the whole question. We don't give airtimes to pieces of shit who shoot at cops and do stuff like that. But and if you go watch the, if you folks just do a little bit internet search, you'll see an interview with this guy. But did you ever come to find out, or did they ever let you know why, you know, so he robbed a bank. What was he so worried about that he wanted to shoot at cops? Was there something else in the vehicle? Was he wanted for something else? What prompted him to open fire on you guys?
He was known. I found out his nickname was called No from New Orleans. And he had supposedly been robbing some banks up there. He's a guy in his early 50s. And he was just known in the streets as like a real scumbag. Even in the hood, they knew him as a scumbag because he had like robbed some older ladies and just not got convicted because they couldn't identify him in a lineup. But all our D Bureau people knew, oh, that dude's a scumbag, you know? And he had taken his wife's car to do the robbery. He was jacked up on cocaine. He had a crack, you know, problem. And his wife's handicapped, so that's why he had the handicap tag on the car. So it all made sense. It was her car. It wasn't like he stole a car to do the robbery. And they were allegedly, he was already being looked at for some other bank robberies. So I figure he knew he was doing the minimum maximum sentencing, you know, with a handgun. He knew he was doing 30 to life and he's 50. He pretty much knows, well, this might be it. And he's jacked up, you know, cocaine. A toxicity report, toxicology, I mean, came back and showed he was like flying. So he probably just did some bumps, you know, and then woo, like over there when they needed change from the bank and they just robbed the place instead of getting, you know, the quarters from the bank in the Griselda show, is that kind of mentality. And yeah, I think that's, he was tapping out and he was just known. I couldn't have actually killed a better guy that was not liked. Like nobody liked this guy. So there's no, oh, you know, nobody coming forward saying, well, he was a good guy that was molested as a little boy and he needed a, you know, he just needed a different environment. He would have been better. It was none of that talk. Everyone was like, well, they killed a scumbag. So I think that helped me a lot, you know.
That's a shame, you know, and it's also a shame that it's, you know, thank goodness those thoughts about how will I be judged didn't come into your mind during the incident, you know, but the fact that afterwards that's your concern. You're not concerned about yourself. You're concerned about, well, how's this going to be viewed? And that's a shame that cops have to do that. That's the environment we live in now. And it's exponentially worse now than it was back in 2012.
Yeah, not like it was, as we say, in our day and stuff like that. I mean, that's a rough time. So let's talk a little bit, too, about because it was very clear. I mean, the Palm Beach County district attorney, you know, the state's attorney, they came out with a very clear statement, said, hey, we've reviewed it, lawful use of force. There will be, this file is closed, no further action. I mean, it was basically a two-sentence statement that said, that was pretty clear. That's the end of it. I mean, they came to a pretty quick judgment. But you talked about how this affected you later on, you know, and this is what we get into, you know, about post. So tell us about post-shooting and your recovery. When did it hit you? I mean, when did it hit you about the enormity of this? And because you don't really realize sometimes what it's going to do to you later, but you kind of go, yeah, man, it's kind of like, have I dealt with everything, or there's still some stuff I need to deal with? I mean, you only went to see a psychologist one time and you're thinking, okay, I'm good, I'm bulletproof, I'm ready to go. But in reality, that's not the whole story.
Yeah, I wasn't bulletproof. I remember being, there's a couple other cops in our department that have been involved in some shootings, and it ended up with people dying from the shooting. One of our own police canines was actually killed in one of these incidents. So I would talk to those guys and, you know, kind of, because they've been to that side of it. And it was, I remember, I'm sorry, I forgot what you were asking me about.
Just, you know, a post shooting, when did it finally get to the point where you realized how much this was going to affect you?
So, you know, I'm out 3 months, you know, I'm doing, you know, everything from 6 weeks at first at home with my kid, whose memory is 6 months old. My first Father's Day, I'm in a boot, you know, spending it with him, thinking about, man, you know, wow, that was close, right? You know, I'm not busy as much right now. I'm playing, you know, video games like Assassin's Creed and stuff, and that's probably not helping. And then I'm sitting there thinking about, man, I got to go back to the road. Am I going to be able to walk? Am I looking at a disability? I didn't know really what I was doing, you know, and I did the therapy. 3 months later, I'm back on the road. I'm 10-8. Back into service exactly 3 months after the shooting. I remember driving around back in uniform. All right, here we are again, you know. And a couple calls I went to, there was one where it was a house alarm, a basic alarm that you have, and you were walking around the house, you know, checking for sliders and open doors. And one of the sliders was open, it slid open. And there was a bike on the side of the house. So, you know what I'm thinking? Oh, we got one of our crackhead burglars probably slid in the back of this house. That's the scenario I created, you know, and we clear this house. You know, it's always weird clearing someone's house you've never been in anyways. It's already kind of getting your, you know, adrenaline going. Turned out to be the homeowner's bike. He left the slider open, false alarm. I remember it took me a while to come down from that one. Like every call throughout the rest of my shift, I was still kind of like, and then I'm reading FBI studies of cops that got killed in 2011 and, you know, how the weird ways they get killed, you know, a shoplifter shot the cop, or noise complaint for fireworks turns out to be a guy with a gun waiting on a cop to come, you know, all this horrible stuff.
Or even worse now, ambushes. You don't even see anything coming, and it's an intentional call to set you up so they can take fire at you for, you know, position of cover and concealment.
Oh, every red light, I couldn't be right next. I had to do the, you know, how you do that whole cat, you try to line up, even though, I mean, if it's your day, it's your day. But, you know, you're doing all this stuff all the time, and it's exhausting. And my drinking's increasing because now I get home, I'm more, man, I need a drink, right? Pores get a little heavier, you know, and I start to escape that way. And then there was another incident where I chase a shoplifter into an apartment complex. He, you know, I'd show up in my car and he's on the bike going the other way. So by the time I catch up to him, he's on foot and I'm looking for him, got my gun out because I just read, just because they're shoplifters doesn't mean they're not wanted for other stuff, right? And got my gun out, and man, I came around the building and he's bladed against the wall, and I was like, let me see your hands. And he puts his hands out and then he reaches in his pocket. And no lie, man, almost. And turns out he was getting his ID. Because he's like, sir, I was so scared. I never had a gun pointed at me, and I was getting my ID. Because that's the only interaction that cat's ever had with cops. And they always want to know, hey, you got any ID on you, right? So in his moment of stress, he went to what he's familiar with and reaching for his ID, which almost got him killed.
Well, so there's an old system out there called the firearms training system. They used to call it FATS, you know, the decision-making. And I remember, you know, you want, if you make your mistakes, you want to make it in training. And I remember one of those things, you show up, there are guys standing there and you're saying, you're doing the command, say, show me your hands. Don't reach in that. And he's reaching into his jacket and he starts to pull out his hand. And before you know, it's there. I pump two shots into him. Well, he pulls out this thing that says, I'm deaf. It's like, fuck.
Yeah.
You know, but lesson learned. We had a buddy of mine, Dave Smith, JD Buck Savage. We had his wife on, Betsy Brantner Smith. But Dave's favorite saying is, watch the hands. That's one of my lessons I learned from that actually saved me from putting a couple rounds into a guy later on that pretended he had a gun and pulled out his fingers instead of a gun. But is watch the hands, right? You know, it took that training system for me to realize, you know, that could have been, like, to your point, that could have been real life. You could have, what would have happened if a white guy in my community had shot an unarmed Mexican male? Right. I mean, it would have been, no matter how legitimate you describe it and how, I was pumped after that, but it's like, but still, to your point, it's like you come so close, it's like, you almost get angry. I got angry.
Oh, yeah. You know, we didn't, none of us signed up to do this job to kill people.
Right.
We signed up to this job to do the job to help people. It's just, you know, this is one of the downsides of the job. So it's, they, you know, people just don't realize how close they come to getting shot by doing stupid things.
Yeah. And I remember that one bothered me. And, you know, I'm drinking more. My wife's like, hey, what's going on? You know, she's starting to be the nosy wife, you know, and I'm not the same. And I'm still trying to come to grips with it. I think I'm the same, right? And an evidence job opened up. Probably, if you asked me 6 months before, the thought of being inside in an evidence job, inside all day long, moving packages and putting them on shelf and checking them out for court, man, get out of here. But I kind of looked at it, and I knew the guy, there was two guys in evidence, and one guy was getting, one lady was getting promoted. So the other guy in there I knew, he's a good guy. So I was like, maybe it's a good thing for me to go into a desk job for about a year or two, just kind of chill. Banker's hours, no, not battling road patrol, but yeah, I'll do this tedious, you know, work. And I applied for it, ended up getting it. There's only a few, you know, nobody really wanted it. So it wasn't like it was stiff competition. And I got it. And it's kind of funny, the guy that I was in competition with ended up tested positive for cocaine like 10 years later. So it was probably a better, good move that I got that job. And that's a whole nother Law and Disorder part of the book. And anyway, so I got into evidence and it was good. I thought it was fine, you know?
But hold on right there. You talked about your drinking was getting, the pores were getting bigger. Did this transition help you with your drinking or did the drinking stay the same?
It stayed the same. But now I took away some of the road patrol stress and now I'm just dealing, you know, I got to make copies for a state attorney, you know, all this BS stuff. But, you know, I'm listening to whatever talk shows I'm listening to, you know, I'm able to like go to the gym middle of the day, you know, I was like, yeah, I like this gig. Well, new chief comes in. Guess what he doesn't like? Having a sworn guy in evidence. Why are we paying a guy 80 grand to be in evidence when we can hire, you know,
a civilian
at 40, even though the whole reason cops are in evidence because the civilians were stealing in 2005. So that's the whole reason we're even in there. So he ended up, that was bouncing around whether I was going to go back to the road. And I'm like, oh no, now I'm going back out there. And that starts the issue of I'm not sleeping. I'm having like, not night terrors, but it was heavily on my mind. And I had talked to somebody and said, hey man, do we have any kind of lawsuit or anything against that guy? You know, I'm thinking, how do I get out? Right? How do I tap out, retire on a disability, but I don't want to go out on disability because can I be a cop again? Can I work at any other job with that stigma of he left, you know, on PTSD, you know? So that was all, you know, in my mind. And then I went to a boss and broke down. He was one of the ones involved in our canine being killed. And he saw what I was going through and he goes, you need to go to EAP and start the process. And I went to that, you know, employee, whatever.
Assistance program.
Yeah. And they said, yeah, you need to see somebody. And I still don't know what to do. I have an open workers' comp case because of my foot. You know, I'm going every year. I had a second surgery in 2014 on it. They removed a tumor. So, you know, it's always there. I got a big scar and I don't feel my big toe. You know, it's just always stuff there from it. And I just remember I go, I should be able to see somebody get this covered, right? Well, then that's, you know, I get the same lawyer I have for my foot to represent me to try to get the help for the mental stuff. And then that starts the new path. At one point, I'm in front of four lawyers in the workman's comp doing this. They want to make sure, I guess, I'm suffering enough so they can authorize me to get this coverage, right? So I break down in front of the whole room and, all right, yeah, he's fucked up. He can get the doctor. So I start seeing this guy, Mark Marnett in Palm Beach Gardens. Greatest guy. He'd already worked with a bunch of veterans and cops that had been in trauma. So he saw me. He already knew when I walked in. And he was pretty much the first guy that ever told me about how it really affected my central nervous system and how I'm going to have to learn how to dance with it, you know, and why I'm staying up at night, why I'm so hypervigilant, why am I acting like this? And he was able to explain it to me. And then we worked on therapies, meditation, and, you know, all that stuff they tell you to do. But drinking was one. I still continued to drink, not as much. And I
what
started.
What was your drink of choice?
It ended up being vodka and, like, you know, whatever, Diet 7-Up or Diet Coke or something like that. I thought I was saving by going diet, and I was actually still killing myself. But I got into the nutrition side of things. I had one of my canine buddies die jogging. He was in great shape, and he had stents put in about 3 years before. So I started thinking about, wow, he died. That guy died of a heart attack? You know, one of those, you know, you always hear the guy that runs marathons die.
Well, you mentioned that. That's what it's going to tie, because early on you said you didn't realize how much the adrenaline dumps were contributing, and I think you said to your heart disease.
Yeah, I got a real bad situation, unfortunately. But the adrenaline dumps, you know, over that time, you know, obviously it's a man-made job. You're not designed to have that much stuff going on with your heart, right? So here I am. I'm about, I guess, about 245, 250 pounds in 2017. Still miserable. I don't know I can retire at 50 yet. I think I got to wait, you know, another 7 years. How am I going to do this? And, one of my friends had lost weight doing this ketogenic way of eating meat and vegetables, right? I'm like, what are you talking about? Burning fat for fuel, all this stuff. So I dove into that world, decided to do it. 6 months later, I was down 35 pounds and feeling great, looking a lot better than I was. You know, I went from 250 and here I am 215 or 220. Guys are asking me, hey,
you looked a little chubby in that interview with the news reporter. You could tell you had,
I didn't even realize it though, you know, looking back. So, you know, I really dove into the health world and I started helping cops at work. Hey, Reynolds, how'd you lose all that weight? You know, and they started calling me keto. Hey, keto, you know, and then it became 5-0, you know, Hawaii 5-0, keto 5-0. And I started helping cops, you know, sheriff's office guys, you know, because remember, they hire all our good guys. So I know a lot of the sheriff's office guys. And we started a little group and I started helping them about, hey, dude, you got to look at the sugar content, the carbs, you got to control this because high fructose corn syrup's more, you know, worse for your heart than regular sugar. You know, just trying to educate them on, at least if you're going to eat some bad shit, do this instead. And that grew into like a little side hustle of, you know, a nice little group of people. I was not making money. It was just a nice little community. So when I ended up retiring, that's when I ended up going to school, become a nutritionist and get my, you know, license in that so I can really understand blood work and help these guys kind of be their health advocate and health coach, you know, and kind of have something behind me to say, yeah, you know, you went to the police academy, got a certificate. Now you're going to really learn the job, you know, and that's what I've been doing.
Yeah. Cause how did cops eat for so long? I can't tell you how many times I drove through a McDonald's or a Wendy's, grab something, you're woofing it down, you know, or you got 30 minutes to eat. So by the time you get home, you know, and God bless the wives and the husbands, you know, who cook for their spouses. Cause you may not get there on time. 7 o'clock becomes 8 o'clock, you know? You know, and then we ate like shit. I'm surprised I didn't have a heart attack, you know, back then, the amount of caffeine, the amount of junk, you know, consuming.
That's why we end up having heart attacks when we retire, because of all that damage we're doing then. I mean, you got to understand, when you're in flight or fight your whole shift and then you come home, you're not even in the middle range. You come all the way down. So you're like in this, like what I heard someone, you know, it's feed and breed. When you come home and sit in your chair, you know, it goes back to the Officer Survival Guide by, I forgot
Kenneth
his
Gilmartin.
Name. Yeah,
Gilmartin. Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement. That book opened my eyes more than any other book. Because I think when you come home, it's like, you want to sit there. You want to be left alone. I don't want to make any decisions. What do you want? I don't care. Just pick something. What do you want to do? I don't care.
And that irritates you too. You're like, oh, no, why do I got to make all the fucking decisions?
Yeah. It does.
So, yeah. So I really got into my health. And, you know, as I started losing the weight, you know, 2019, I was able, I heard that if you had, Boyden's got this real funny thing with their retirement. If you got over 15 years of service and you're over 50 years old, you can retire and start collecting your pension. So I was like, I was 49. And I still needed to do like four more years. But because I was turning 50, I'm now eligible to start collecting my pension. I wasn't getting promoted. I wasn't doing any special assignments to make it. You know, my pension was not going to grow. You know, the only way it would grow was raises through the city. And we were 7 years at that point without a raise. So I'm like, well, there ain't no raise coming, you know. And I decided to retire. We sold our house and we bought a, well, there's more to it. I found a brother in between that time. And then he'd been into camping and RVing. And then we ended up doing RVing. So it was like, he was my guardian angel to help us, you know, fly out of this situation.
Okay, so you can't just, Murph said, you just can't, okay, by the way, I found a brother I didn't know about. Okay, rewind 2019. So tell us the process, because this gets into what you're doing now, the Cops and Campers. By the way, I looked, checked out the site, checked out the video. I think it's, I think that's a cool idea. But how did you come about the process of finding out you had a half brother?
Well, in 2016, I'd done the DNA thing. I already figured they got my DNA from all my investigations anyways, so it's out there. So I did 23andMe, not that this is a sponsor or anything. And I could see, you know, I always knew my mom's side being the Cuban side of things. I knew that they originated in like Spain, you know, and I was kind of curious about that area of the world.
But you get this little fork way over here. You go, what the hell is that? Right.
And I knew there was heavy English, Irish, and Viking country. You know, I don't know who, am I part of the invading team or in the receiving team? I always joke around. I don't know what side of the DNA I am, but it was interesting, you know, and didn't think much. And then that summer, it was July 11, 2019. I'm flying high. I already know I'm out in 3 months. Hurricane season coming. I'm like, we're going to do stupid Alpha Bravos again, which I hated. Once I had kids, I didn't care about the city. I care about my family. But yet I got to.
You said Alpha Bravos. What's
yeah,
that?
When there's hurricanes coming, we go 12-hour shifts. And then, okay, you know, you can end up being stuck at the department or a library or a hospital. And then meanwhile, your kids and family are still at the house trying to survive. So that was a whole nother psychological thing going on at that point. So doing the Alpha Bravos, I'm ready to leave. And then I get an email. Somebody wants to contact you, you know, from your DNA. And it's always like a third cousin. We had the same great grandfather. Oh, cool. Later, you know.
Okay, bye.
So, yeah, exactly. So this one says, hi. My name is Dave Stahl, and I know very little about my birth parents. I was adopted as an infant. And it says, I did 23andMe because I was curious about my health benefits because my parents aren't living anymore. He goes, according to 23andMe, we're half brothers. Not only that, we're both cops and we both live in Florida. So I'm reading this at breakfast at 2J's. I got my omelet and sausages. I asked Dan, my evidence partner, I'm like, dude, what the hell? Like, look at this. And he reads it and he's like, dude, you got a brother. I go, nah, this got to be a scam, right? He's like, well, call the department. So I email back, and turns out he's an Orange County Sheriff's Sergeant. He's in charge of the courthouse. He's in the drop plan. He's about to retire.
And, so how far away are you physically?
2 hours. 2 hours. He actually worked Hurricane Andrew when my mom was there. I was in college. He was actually a cop in Orlando and came down to help. So they could have crossed paths back then. And it's not even her son. That's my dad's son from another rendezvous, as we say. So now I'm talking to this guy on the phone. He's my brother, right? And I'm like, how old are you?
How did that conversation go?
Weirdest thing. It's like someone dropped a clone out of like another planet and said, hey, this is your brother. And he's like, nanu nanu or some shit, you know? And just going, I remember the first time we talked, I was in the truck in the parking lot and I was drinking a vodka and I was drinking, Tito's. And I'm like, hey, man, how's it going? I go, you nervous? I go, I had to make a drink. He's like, yeah, I had to make a drink too. I go, what are you drinking? He's like, Tito's. I go, I'm drinking Tito's. We are brothers. You know, it was just as a joke. I mean, everyone drinks Tito's. But it was a funny little moment that we're both drinking Tito's. And then I think within a couple of days, I drove up. You know, we went over, all right, where were you born? Pensacola. And then I got to call my dad.
Oh, no, hey, hold Dad. On. This is going to be interesting. Two cops trying to talk to each other. It almost sounds like it's an interrogation as opposed to, hey, you're my brother. Okay, what's your name? Where do you live? What's your date of birth? Social security number, scars, marks, tattoos.
Well, I'm sitting there. I'm like, man, my parents had me at 19, right? 1969. I'm like, my mom was in high school in 1968. My dad wasn't. My dad was in high school 67. I'm like, there's a year there. there's a year my dad was a free agent, right? So I'm like, I go, Dave, that's my brother's name. I go, Dave, I'm going to call my dad, our dad? How are we referring to this cat? You know, because he's my dad, but it's your birth dad. He's like, nah, call him. So I go, hey, dad. Hey, what's up, son? I go, craziest thing happened. I did one of those 23andMe DNA tests, and he got real silent. And he's been married 5 times. So he's had multiple wives and some kids spread out. And he was in the service. So I think the days in Okinawa or something, I think he was a little worried there's a little Johnny Toshiba out there that might be related to us. So when I'm like, yeah, I did the 23andMe. And he goes, yeah. I go, and you know what it said? He says, wait a minute, dad. I go, you got a brand new 50-year-old bouncing baby boy. And he stood up, left the phone there. And then my stepmom picks up the phone. She's like, what'd you just tell him? I go, well, might as well tell you. He's got another son. That's the oldest. His oldest son is walking around. He's a cop in Orlando. And they were just like, what? And I sent them the pictures. They ended up meeting. We ended up having a big family reunion where we all got together. But at this point, it was backtracking. And I'm like, dad, where were you in the fall of 1967? This is 2019 for this old man, 70 years old, trying to remember who he was kicking it with in 1967, right? But he remembered. He goes, I was working at Zayre's. And I was in the paint department. There was this young girl in the lingerie department. Typical roles back then, right? Men in the paint, women in lingerie. And he had a little relationship with her. And she had told him once that she was pregnant. And he goes, well, I guess we got to get married because that's just what you did. And she came back later, says it was a bad test. She wasn't pregnant. So he never really thought much of it. Turns out she was. She was promised to somebody else. And that guy did not want to raise someone else's child. So after 6 months, she put Dave up for adoption. And he was adopted by a Navy family, a Navy pilot, helicopter pilot. And he was a pretty big wig over there in Pensacola, big enough to where he got promoted to the officer in charge at the San Diego base out there. So Dave grew up in San Diego as a military kid on this base. Not only that, he was there when Top Gun was filmed. And since his dad was living on the big house as the officer in charge, he has pictures with Goose wearing Goose's jacket. You know, this kid's living this Hollywood life, and I'm sitting there, my mom's solving cartel, you know, shootings and stuff, and he's surfing, you know, his emails like Wavy Davy. I'm like, dude, you live like this freaking great life. And I'm worried you were like in an orphanage or you were abused. He's like, no, wasn't abused. And he's like, my dad moved to West Virginia when he retired. I was 17. I went with him. And I thought the beach, and I said, let me go down to Florida and check out the beaches there. And he ended up in Orlando, and he applied as a cop at 21, got it. And that's where he was, you know, and he got married, no kids of his own. And his adopted dad, the Navy helicopter pilot, actually has the same birthday as I. It was kind of weird that we had that connection. Not the same year, of course. And, you know, we
kind of figured that one out on our own. Okay.
Well, he ended up, there were some people on his DNA list that weren't mine. And I go, Dave, that's your mom's side of the family. I go, you got to send that third cousin an email. And he did. And, you know, and he ended up finding two more sisters on that side. So he's got, on my dad's side, he's got three brothers and a sister. And then on his mom's side, he's got two more sisters. And there's a whole thing that the daughters were watching NBC Nightly News with Lester Holt at the very end, were the very good news clip that they put at the very end. And they knew they had a brother out there. The mom had finally divulged that years later that she put a kid out for adoption. So they're 40-year-old ladies now, right? They're wondering, you know, and they're watching that show. And here's these two cops on the show. And they're talking about brothers in blue, blah, 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 you know, hyping us up that they found each other and all this stuff. And they were like, wow, wouldn't that be crazy if that's our brother? Turns out it was. Because they ended up meeting, and he got to meet his birth mother. She was in a home for cancer treatments. She was very sick, and she ended up dying like less than 6 months later. So it's kind of a weird, like Lifetime movie that he finally found his birth mom, and maybe that set her free on some weird level, you know. But anyways, he'd been camping, and he's like, you ever gone RVing? I'm like, nah, I didn't, you know, my wife's trying to get me in this tiny house thing. I think she's crazy. Like, put a storage unit or storage shed in the woods and build off of it. And he goes, let's
shipping
go camp.
Container. Yeah. The metal door.
He rented a camper or helped me rent one, and we camped with him, you know. And then I was like, man, this is a pretty good little dope lifestyle. You just walk outside, the environment's different, but your bed's the same. And then, you know, it was just awesome. And here he is, my big brother helping me. So then, we haven't even heard from Netflix yet. Amazing Race contacts us. Or they go, hey, would you guys be interested in auditioning and coming on the Amazing Race? I'm like, Amazing Race? I go, I hate running, right? I didn't know it was like a scavenger hunt show. I mean, me and Dave binge watched it. And he's like, I'm not doing any singing. He's like, I go, well, I'm not jumping out of any planes. He's like, I'll jump out of the plane. I go, all right, I'll do the singing. So we start breaking stuff down. I still don't know this guy. Still 50 years of stories to catch up on, you know? And here we are going to audition for the Amazing Race. It's like, what the heck? So we sent in our tape. Netflix, Doug Miro, the one of the executive producers, now calls my department at this time. I'm thinking, I'm going to Hollywood, right? And they're like, hey, you know, we were listening to a podcast with you. And I was like, yeah, because I had done like one or two Law Enforcement Today podcasts. And they're like, there was one real interesting one with your mother. I was like, yeah, that was the one my mom did one. It's got more hits than anything else, of course, than any of the 40 I did, you know. But they were like really intrigued on her involvement in those days. You know, they had seen the Cocaine Cowboys and did their research, you know, and she kept popping up. They're like, we'd love to talk to your mom. Like, absolutely, you know. So I got my mom with them, and I think it was Doug and Eric flew to my mom's house in Tennessee. They got lost, so Al had to go down. He's a volunteer fireman now in the woods up there, so he's a hero guy saving these Hollywood executives coming into the mountains of Tennessee. And they wrote everything down. My mom was like, we were just telling stories, and they were like, oh, that's great, you know, everything from, you guys ever hear about the leather chair story? All right. So back when my mom got the homicide, this didn't make the show. This is behind the scenes stuff for you guys. My mom had a brand new leather chair in homicide. She couldn't figure out how the new girl would get a, you know, new chair. She knows how it works. You get the worst squad car. So Al or somebody told her later on that a couple of guys would sniff the chair when she left. Did you see it coming? Kind of.
Well, It was, I didn't see that one exactly. But the other thought was, though, is that either somebody had soiled themselves in it and nobody wanted to sit in it. Kind of the same thing, right? You know, nobody wants to be in that chair.
Yeah. So that scene when they turn on the AC and they, you know, try to get her chest all hard. And it's, so she, you know, this is what I'm realizing years later, all the stuff my mom really went through, you know, stuff she couldn't share with an 8-year or 9-year old, you know. But anyway, so the Narcos thing happens. I'm like, wow, cool. The Amazing Race. I'm flying out to in December. Dave and I are flying out to LA for casting. And I'm like, Dave, is this really, you know, remember, I just retired. Like, everything is happening. And I'm like, we're going Hollywood. This is great, you know? And at that time, there's something floating out there called COVID, right? And we're like, oh, this is COVID thing. I don't know. It's over in China. I don't care. And Doug Miro had happened to say, hey, we're going to LA for Amazing Race. He's like, oh, I got tickets for the Chargers. Let's go to the Chargers game. I'm like, I'm going to the Chargers game with Doug Miro. And I was like, this is awesome. You know, think I'm going to be super famous or something. You know, you kind of get starstruck a little bit because like Amazing Race, you can win $1 million. I'm like, how are we going to win this thing? If we're going to go do this stuff, let's win it. Right. And yet I don't know Dave. I can see, and he's a sergeant, so I got to take orders from him, not only as a sergeant, but as a big brother now, right? So I'm like, this is going to be crazy. And then they delay us till February. They say, hey, we're going to push you back to season 34. Turns out we're going to go with the 10 casting members we have now, push you back to the next season. I'm like, okay. Well, February comes, lockdowns.
And guess what hits? Yeah.
We never hear. And then that summer, they're flipping police cars and burning police cars in LA. I'm like, well, I don't know if we're making it out there, Dave. I think that ship is gone, right? And it was, never came back. But it was all good. I don't know, really being away for that long a period overseas, away from my family, would have done for me mentally. I don't know. I'm just thinking the control thing we have and protecting, I would have been losing my marbles over there. But yeah, COVID hit. We'd sold our house. We ordered a rig already, a camper. We're just waiting on that to come in. And then it showed up in July and we hooked up and we left. And we've been on the road ever since.
Really?
Yep. Full time. We homeschool our kids.
I mean, today, as we are interviewing you, give us an idea of where you're at and what you're in.
Well, I'm in it's a toy hauler. It's an aluminum trailer with this is actually the ramp that opens up in the back. So you would see the big view I got behind us. But it's hot today in South Florida. And I'm at my brother-in-law's house. We're kind of sneaking under code enforcement. They don't know we're here. So we're just in his driveway. He's got a big bush line. So we're hooked up, saving some money until we head up to Tennessee and Georgia for a couple of events I got up there. So we're just down here. We do regular state parks. We bounce around. But because this one's right in the central hub of my wife's family, this isn't a nice spot to be. So we slide in here. We have access to a house, you know, and then we go do our camping thing. So yeah, we've seen we saw five Great Lakes in 2021. My kids, we swam in them. I mean, that's when the flag thing happened in New York, where they tried to kick me out of a campground for my flag. You know,
I saw that. You're flying the thin blue line flag, and people got offended by it.
Yeah, and then the camping group, Thousand Trails, that I was complaining about with this whole flag thing, they suspended me for 2 months because I was belligerent, which I was. You know, I gave the guy a piece of my mind that was telling me to, and I'd recorded it and then put it out there, and it kind of got viral. Local news agency started interviewing me. They had a rally. There was like 50 thin blue line trucks with flags and causing chaos. The state police stopped us from getting to the campground because we had a bunch of cops there going to throw down their flags at the same time. We were going to totally screw with this campground. And they got wind of it and stopped us. State police come out with their masks, like freaking Gestapos, to stop a bunch of cops. It's freaking crazy. They wouldn't take our bottled water because it's looked at as a gift or some crap. I was like, oh my God, what has happened to this country? So, you know, at one point I was in the back of the car saying, you know, we're going to go to pro cop campgrounds, you know, and it's going to be called Cops and Campers. I just said it. And then I started looking up, you know, some stuff about how to, you know, Facebook groups of cops at camp. And I found three of them. There's like 1,000 deep. I'm like, we need to unite these. Let's get all these guys together. Where are you guys going camping? Oh, there's a great place in Florida, a great place in Ohio. You start kind of gathering information and you're meeting people and they're like, that's bullshit what they did with the flag. I'm like, I know, I was just trying to camp and now it's a movement, you know, and turned into some really good stuff. And I ended up going nonprofit with the organization in November, and we focus on getting the guys together. And it's just outdoor therapy. It's campfires. It's, you might meet a guy that likes to fly fish. You go fly fishing. You know, another guy might just want to just talk. Some guys don't want to talk. They're just there. And that's better than them sitting at home by themselves, you know. And the wives will come up to me and say, thank you, John needed this so much. You know, he just was looking for something because you retire, not in roll call anymore. You know, the same thing. You're not part of the gang. Well, you can only go to so many diners. You can only go to the bar so much. You know, there's some other things that were happening. And as I traveled with my flag, I'd meet first responders, military, firemen, you know, corrections, dispatchers, because they see the flag. And first of all, you know, I don't look 54. People would walk up and say, oh, is your dad a cop or something like that? You know, or who's the cop in your family? And I'm like, no, it's me. And they're like, what? You know, when'd you retire? I go, I'm 54. They're like, what? And then it gets into nutrition. Well, you got to watch the weight, you know, because I ended up, I don't know if I told you, I ended up losing 80 pounds. You know, I went from 250 pounds to 176 pounds. You know, my body fat went from 28% down to 12%. All my numbers were good, but, you know, I still got the heart damage from the career and being obese. So that's some of the stuff I deal with now. I got to watch my inflammation, my carbohydrate intake. You know, I'm not on a statin. I'm not on any of that stuff, but there is some other stuff going on that's related to the career that, you know, I'd like guys to be aware, you know, that that career is damaging to our hearts and we don't have the same life expectancy as the average guy. And as long as you know that, maybe that'll help some of your decision-making along the way, whether it's diet, alcohol, or seeking therapy, and just trying to do better things mentally for yourself.
Well, but, and it's trying to have a good quality of life, you know, in the next decade, right? I mean, you don't have to be miserable. You can be good. I mean, and like you say, it just involves watching some things. Hey, real quickly, let's tell everybody about, as we close this out, let's tell her, give us the information about Cops and Campers. Tell us about your site. Where can they find you? And look, we've got some friends too. My wife and I've got some really good friends. They love the camping thing. They just bought a brand new camper, a bigger one. And so they love doing that. So I got to hook them up with you. So people want to learn more. Where do they go, Ert?
Well, the first place is copsandcampers.com. That should have the latest information. We have two events. We got one in LAJ, Georgia in April, which is near Blue Ridge. It's a big RV resort, top class. They want to make this a yearly event. They want to make it like Bike Week in Daytona. They want to make it Cop Camping Week in Atlanta. So they're big cop supporters. I got one in New York at the first. When I got suspended from that camping group, four different campgrounds reached out on social media and said, hey, tell that cop to have him bring his flag, his rig, and his truck and his family. They're staying with us. And they covered the whole 2 months we were suspended. We stayed up in all these crazy places, different campgrounds. And that's where I was meeting different cops coming up, giving me challenge coins and saying, hey, BS on the flag. Keep doing what you're doing, brother. You know, and it was like, wow, maybe we should keep going with this. So copsandcampers.com. If you need help with any nutrition or health coaching or advice, you can go to keto50.com. That's my health side of it. I don't charge first responders. There's prices on there, but I found that the more I help people, it's just easier. I can't be trying to hustle making money on that because it's not what I'm all about. You know, I just want somebody, usually within a month or two, if I work with you, I set you free and you already know good habits and you can then work on yourself, you know, but Cops and Cabins is now my passion. Like I said, I went nonprofit. We have these two events coming up. We did do a documentary film in 2022. It's only about 32 minutes long. It's on YouTube. It's just, we're trying to show how therapeutic this is for the guys and the bonding, and the wives and the, or the spouses even get together in their own little groups, because trust me, they got a bunch to talk about us. And they're all similar. You know, the same shit's happening here, it's happening over there. And you know what? Now they got friends. They got someone to vent to. And it's really been just, it's just camping. But yet, it's camping with like-minded people who have gone through the same experiences. One of the best things I could ever do at a campfire is just, let's have a question. The funniest time in your career as a cop or whatever. And all those different stories that you hear, it's hilarious. I mean, it's some of the best belly laughs. You know, and I think these guys are missing it out.
No, I know what you're doing. That's called cataloging blackmail. So when you're out later, hey, remember that time? You want somebody to really hear this?
It's not recorded, though, for the most part. So.
For the most part, I like
that. I'm looking at your Cops and Campers website right now, and there's a place to donate on there also. So, you know, if you want to support the Blue, go on. I mean, this is an outstanding event you've got going on with the campers. The PTSD thing is real. This past weekend, I went to a military appreciation weekend up in Beaufort, South Carolina. And, you know, I was the keynote speaker. And the first question is, what the hell's a retired cop up here talking to all you military types about? But it's the same thing. You know, it's a brotherhood and sisterhood. And the one thing I always like to recognize when I do those type of things is the unsung hero. And that's the families that have to put up with all our bullshit to keep things going while we're out. You know, I mean, I love being a cop. You know, that was how I had fun, but it's stressful in your family as well. So check it out, man. It's the things, just getting together where you can network, where you talk to people that think the same of you, that went through some of the same experiences that you did, that might not be comfortable talking to a counselor that they don't know. Why would I open up to you? You don't even know who the hell I am. This is fantastic what you've come up with. So for our listeners out there, if you're looking for a really, really good cause to support here, check out copsandcampers.com and see what you can do to help out these people. Believe me, the cops, it's like we said earlier in this interview, cops didn't take the job to kill people. We took the jobs to help people, but this is what comes along with it. So brother, it's been a freaking hoot having you on here. I'm so glad you reached out.
Thank you. Dan, we do have therapies at these events. I am bringing in practitioners that can help people with their metabolic disease and diabetes and stuff like that. That is part of the goal. It's not just mental health. It's also physical health.
Physical health.
And yeah, we do take those donations, and it does provide a cop that may need a camper for the weekend. We will rent a camper, provide the spot. Maybe somebody recently just went through some shit and needs to get away with the family. Hey, have them come in Atlanta, this event in Blue Ridge, I'm sorry, in LJ, Georgia. I'm going to have June and Al from Griselda there. My brother Dave's going to be there. So there is going to be some meet and greet opportunities to meet some other warriors in this world that we've all gone through. Whether you're on Netflix or not, we all have our own stories. We've all suffered. And we all sometimes need to talk to people because it's so therapeutic to get it out there. So I appreciate you guys really having me on. And hopefully you're not too hard on my mom, you know. There's some stories there, boy. She was, yeah, she's all nice on, you know, video. But whew, those were some rough years there a couple of times.
Let me tell you, after talking to her for 30 minutes yesterday, I don't think anybody's going to run over your mom.
No. Well, we'll get some good stuff out of her, and then we'll come back and use it against you. It's called compromise, you know, compromising material. Hey, you know, hey, by the way, but I think before we close off, you made one important mention. Just because you're listening, just because you don't have a camper, don't let that stop you. Like you say, part of the raising funds is to get you a camper. It's just, the important thing is just show up and do something and get the hell away from society and technology. Just get out back where men were designed to be. You know, there's this great book, and it said men want three things: battle to fight, adventure to live, beauty to save. You know, you got to get back to that root. So, hey, this is us, pal. What a great honor. And it's been fun. Yeah. This is us saluting you. Thank you, not just for your service, but what you're doing. You know, you're going to help far more people post-retirement now with what you're doing. So, hey, just keep doing that stuff, man. And keep sending us stories about your mom, because we gotta have some fun stuff with her when we interview her. So
I know. This thing about my mom, I'm always like, hey, my mom wears SWAT boots and your mom wears loafers or something. You know, there's always some joke in there. But no, this has been great, man. And thank you for letting me open up and get this off my chest, because every time I do this, it's more, you know, help. It's a little bit easier and easier and easier, and I can help other guys and ladies too, you know.
Well, let's stay in touch, brother.
All right. And need you at one of the shows, man. We have glamping. We got tents. So, I mean, there's all kinds of fanciness we could have for you guys. I know you guys are big wigs, you know, so maybe we get a big RV you guys can pull up.
Murph needs a limo and a, you know, first class ticket before he goes.
No, I'm taking a private jet here.
Where's all that Narcos money? Come on. No,
that's the question I have.
Where is it?
Well, I'll tell you where it's not. It's not in my bank account.
Yeah, it's not in the Murphy account.
And the last time somebody messed with Pablo's money, he cut him up at the La Catedral.
That's true. We should probably stay away from collecting. So.
Stay away from narco money. Hey, well, hey, dude, again, Eric, thank you so much. Thank you for being here. Everybody, you guys don't go anywhere. Everybody else, stay tuned for the debrief. Like Keto 5-0. I thought that was a great name for a business. Keto 5-0.
Well, that and Cops and Campers.
Yep.
So these are, you just heard him tell you the story about everybody. Check out the websites, copsandcampers.com and then Keto 5-0, all is one word, KETOFIVEO.com. You know, here's the guy, Eric, you heard his story. Here's a guy who could have just kind of given up on humanity and said, you know, screw it all, you know, almost killed in the line of duty, was forced to take a life. You heard his reaction from that. That's not what I love about that is the fact that it's genuine. You're seeing his heartfelt reaction. We said here on the show 100 times, if not more, that every police officer we've met, I haven't met a single cop anywhere in the world that joined the police department to kill people. We all know it's something you may be called on to do. You hope it never happens in your career. And you could hear the emotion in Eric's voice as he was reliving that on the show. Brother, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And then you hear the story about where he's just going camping with his kids, and he and his wife are homeschooling their children to go to a campground in Ithaca, New York. And lo and behold, they come over and tell him he's got to take down his thin blue line flag. Well, I love the fact that he videotaped that. And it's a little, if you haven't seen it, go on Cops and Campers, you'll see the video. It's a little graphic, I'll tell you, because he got heated, and I don't blame him one bit. You know, you've got all this stuff going on. He's making the best of, he's out helping every police officer in their family he can. And then before he retires, he finds out he's got a half brother he never knew about who's also a cop in Florida. I mean, you can't make this shit up, right?
And they were not that far away from each other. So, and how does he find out about it? You know, that's, you're going to have to, you know, finds out about it just through the DNA testing, you know, ancestry.com, you know, it's 20 ancestry and me, you know, 23 and me, you know, so finding out, you know, when I did that, that's one of the things I look for. I said, anybody out there I need to know about? And no brothers, no sisters. No, we're.
Yeah, I don't think I want to know.
Yeah, well, your case, Murphy, it'd be very difficult, you know. You're related to everybody in Kentucky and Tennessee and West Virginia, so.
That's it. But this, I got to say, you know, as much as we love June coming on, his mom telling her story, and it is a phenomenal story about what she endured as a police officer, female police officer in a Metro-Dade police agency. Eric's interview has been one of the most motivational we've had on in quite some time here. I mean, brother, God bless you for what you did for your community, for what you suffered through, how you continue to suffer, but you're not letting it get you down, how you're trying to help others. I love the fact that it's like Kevin Black found his birth parents. If you remember Kevin, he's the one who crapped his pants when he was in cop in North Carolina. And if you haven't heard Kevin Black's interview, you got to go back and listen to that, because you'll be crying, not from sad stories, but from laughing so hard.
And I'm telling you, that's one guy that should have worn a kilt.
You know, we get so many comments about Kevin from cops that know him. They're like, you know, that story's true. And that's not the only time he shit his pants. So we may have to get Kevin back on for the rest of the story at some point. I don't know.
Well, back to our regularly scheduled outro for this podcast. But no, hey, it was great to have. The other fun thing, too, was Eric put out comments on Facebook. He tagged some people. And he even said, man, I never saw these pictures. I mean, it tugged at the heartstrings. He said, I never saw these great pictures of him and his mom graduating at the top of her class, which was important because that was voted on by the students, not the instructor. So it was peer recognition, which is just super. But he's got a great story too. And the Cops and Campers, like I said, on the front page, you'll see, watch how this movement got started. So he takes a negative, turns it into a positive, and he's dedicating his time to healthy living, healthy eating, a healthy mindset, you know, and helping others do the same thing.
You know, and just yesterday evening, I got a text message from Eric where he cut out a clip from his mom's interview to send to me, and it's right at the end where she makes reference to AAA.
Ha, 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 ha. I knew you couldn't get through this whole thing without bringing that up again.
I know. So, Eric, thank you, brother. It's just been a pleasure having your mom here.
I was set up. I want it on the record. I was set up.
I did not ask either one of them to mention AAA.
I'm going to put you on a polygraph.
I told them about AAA, but I didn't say anything. They took that upon themselves.
I can't tell you to say anything, but if you say AAA, you'll see his reaction. But don't say I said to say anything.
If you happen to say that, you might get paid double zero, still zero, but you get paid.
Double nothing, yeah.
Okay, I love guys. This. This has been fantastic. Thank you, Eric.
Well, we are in trouble already, so. Hey, but guys, hopefully if you enjoyed that, leave us some comments. You can do that on especially Spotify. You can leave comments on there. So head on over to Apple, Spotify, hit those 5 stars. Really helps us out. Head on over to GameOfCrimesPodcast.com for more information about the show. You'll see the pictures of what he was talking about with June. You'll see some of Eric's pictures, his transformation from when he retired to the way he looks now. Huge transformation. Follow us on social media at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook, and the Instagram, but where you got to be, patreon.com/Game of Crimes. If you want to hear the full kilt story, if you want to go full commando on the full kilt story, you got to go to patreon.com/Game of Crimes and listen to our latest installment of You Can't Make This Shit Up. Right, Murph?
Absolutely. And I'm looking at Eric's pictures here on his website. The man's got a killer smile. I mean, you could just tell this is a man loving life. This is so fantastic. But please join us on Patreon. We love it there. You've heard us make reference to You Can't Make This Shit Up. We go into some really, this time they were very graphic, gross stories. But we do our monthly Q&A where we have not turned down a single question yet.
By the way, Chris is listening. Chris, we got your question late. We'd already recorded the episode, Chris from Chuuk from Micronesia. So we're going to have his question in next month's Q&A. If you're listening out there, Chris.
Hey, Chris, you know, I'm coming over there. So please swing by. There's a place called the Truck Stop Inn. You might stop by and say hello. Be good to meet you in person. Oh,
like Truck Lagoon?
Yeah, Truck Lagoon. Supposed to be the best wreck diving site in the world.
There you go. Hey, and by the way, too, make sure you head on over to Game of Crimes fans. Type that into the search function of Facebook.com. Our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato, rules with the iron fist and the velvet glove. Get you inside. This is where we have a lot of the good discussion. So head on over there. But guys, most importantly, just go out there, have fun, take some lessons away from this episode and realize life is too short. You know, get healthy, do some fun stuff, and always remember, be safe when you're playing the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all. The Game of Crimes.